Bhishma and Drona's change of bodies, Vasamsi Jirnani Yatavahaya. It is just like giving up old and useless garments and accepting new garments. That is what's going to happen. So what is the problem? So after explaining that the soul of Bhishma and the soul of Drona and all the kings that are assembled, that they are eternal. Now Krishna is going to continue explaining the qualities of the soul in a very analytical way. Again, this type of understanding on the jnana platform is usually reached through an analytical study that is inactive. Someone will go to the forest, not engage in any activities whatsoever, and just fix himself. He doesn't want to engage his body in any activities because he's trying to understand that he is not the body. And he turns his consciousness from outside, as we usually have our consciousness, inside, and trying to understand exactly who he is through the power of intelligence and different practices. So it is an inactive path where one gives up all activities. So here are some of the realizations on this jnana platform. Nainam chindanti shastrani, nainam dohati pavaka, na chainam kledhyantya po, na shoshayati marutaha. The soul, Krishna is telling Arjuna, you are there on the battlefield, my dear Arjuna, and you have your arrows in your quiver, you have your different astras, you have your water weapon, you have your wind weapon, you have your fire weapon, you have so many different weapons. But you should know that the soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon. So if you're worrying that you're going to kill Bhishma, you should understand that your arrows, as sharp as they are, cannot cut Bhishma, because Bhishma is a soul. You cannot cut him. He is not the body, he's a soul. So the soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire. You have a fire weapon, it cannot burn the soul. Your water weapon, it cannot moisten the soul, nor your wind weapon, that cannot wither and dry up this eternal soul. So this is the nature of the soul. It is existing eternally. And this is us. And this philosophy that is presented in the first verses practically of the Bhagavad Gita is the foundation. I'm practically speaking, after Krishna mentions it here, he doesn't mention it again because everyone understood this. And to this day even in the Vedic culture, even the villagers who are uneducated and can't read, they understand that they are not their bodies, but they are eternal souls. This knowledge is the heritage of the Vedic culture. And one who takes his birth in Bharadvasha practically automatically attains this platform, which is far beyond even the highest realizations of the greatest scientists of the world. They know so many things, how to compute in so many different languages, how to make tremendous bombs and how to make planes that go so fast, but they don't even know who they are. And therefore they're always in anxiety and always envious. So this knowledge, and they don't know where they're going. This is the most frightening thing. Not knowing what's going to happen to us at the time of death. They are living as if they were material bodies, and therefore they are performing so many abominable activities. And all of modern civilization is based on this miscalculation, which is the same miscalculation that Arjuna is basing all his calculations on. He is not accepting the eternality of the soul. So the soul cannot be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. This individual soul is unbreakable. You may hit it, the soul, with a gada.
Gada?
The club. You may be an expert club fighter and you might smash your enemy, but you cannot break the soul. The individual soul is unbreakable. He is insoluble. And he can neither be burned nor dried. He is everlasting. He is present everywhere. This present everywhere, the sarva-gataha, doesn't mean that there is one soul, like the Mayavadis say, who is everywhere. It means that everywhere there are souls. Right now, we count, if I say how many people are in this room, maybe there's 20, 25. But if we say how many souls are in this room, well, that's, I just caught 700 zillion billion of them. We'll let them go. Huh? No. They can't. How can you kill the soul? There's unlimited souls. They're everywhere. Even in the atoms. Even in within one body. One time, one devotee was talking to Prabhupada and said, there are so many souls within the body, isn't it? So Prabhupada, yes, there are so many souls in the body. Because there, you know, there's so many bugs and amoebas, and especially there are so many more in my body right now. But there's so many souls in one body. So the person said, the devotee said to Prabhupada, that means if I eat prasadam, that all these souls are benefited. And Prabhupada said, oh, you are so merciful, you are eating for others. But it's true that there are souls everywhere. They are sarva gataha. They are everywhere. So the soul is present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. So all your weapons, Arjuna, they cannot cut, burn, dry, wither, or in any way hurt the eternal soul. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. It cannot change, it cannot be changed. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. Now, atacha. Atachainam nityajatam. This atacha means there's going to be a change of topic. Now Krishna is going to change his logic. Up to this point he's saying, what is this nonsense, my disciple Arjuna? You are afraid, you are saying you don't want to fight because you don't want to kill Bhishma and Drona. But here I'm showing you that you can't kill Bhishma and Drona because listen to the qualities of the soul. But now, Krishna is going to change his argument. If, however, you think that the soul or the symptoms of life is always born and dies forever, in other words, if you think that the soul comes into existence and then goes out of existence, just like the body, practically, if you think that the body, if there is no soul, there is only the body, just like the modern scientists. They refuse to accept the existence of the soul. So if you think that the symptoms of life or the soul is always born and dies forever, that means life comes from matter and dies, you still have no reason to lament, O Arjuna, Prabhupada explains in the purport. Even if Arjuna did not believe in the existence of the soul, as in the Vaibhashika philosophy, there would still have been no cause for lamentation. No one laments the loss of a certain bulk of chemicals and stops discharging his prescribed duties. So, if we think, this is the irony of it, that if someone says, the scientists say that there is no soul, then why are they crying? When the body dies, if it is just chemicals, what is the problem? So many chemicals are spread on the fields every day for fertilizing. So many chemicals are dumped into the water for purifying. So many chemicals are mixed together to make one thing or another. So what is the problem if you think that this body is just is the self and there is no eternal soul? What is the problem? If you think it's chemicals, what are you lamenting about? You cannot think my uncle, my cousin, my brother, my loved one, my friend is just chemicals. There is no person there. It is just chemicals. So who will cry and stop doing what they're supposed to do just because some chemicals will be spilled? Say if you're in the laboratory and you're mixing one chemical with another chemical, and by mistake your elbow hits something and one bag of chemicals spills over. You'll say, oh no, the chemical spills over. And then you lift it up and you keep on with your work. You don't start crying. You don't start lamenting. You don't say, oh, I will never mix chemicals again. I will leave. I will run away and adopt. Begging is my profession because I have spilled chemicals. How absurd. So similarly, no one laments the loss of a certain bulk of chemicals. Of course, this isn't Krishna's philosophy, that we are just chemicals. But he's defeating Arjuna from either side. He's saying, if you think that there is a soul, if you accept the Vedic view that there is a soul, then what is the question of you leaving the battle because you're going to be killing these people? And if you think, on the other hand, that there is no soul, that it is just chemicals, that life is just chemicals, then what is the question of leaving the battlefield just because of the loss of chemicals? So either way, whichever way you're thinking, you should do your duty and fight. So this is what Krishna is pushing Arjuna to do at this time. He wants him to do his duty and fight. There are so many different levels that one can do his duty on. But the basic level is that you have to do your duty. There's different levels of consciousness. But at this point, Krishna is just simply pushing Arjuna to fight. On the other hand, in modern science and scientific warfare, so many tons of chemicals are wasted for achieving victory over the enemy. According to the Vaibhashika philosophy, the so-called soul or atma vanishes along with the deterioration of the body. That means there is no eternal soul. So in any case, whether Arjuna accepted the Vedic conclusion that there is an atomic soul, or he did not believe in the existence of the soul, he had no reason to lament. According to this theory, since there are so many living entities generated out of matter every moment, and so many of them are being vanquished every moment, there is no need to grieve for such incidents. And he continues. Krishna continues, just defeating Arjuna, pummeling him with logical point after logical point after logical point. You believe in the soul? Fight. You don't believe in the soul? Fight. And if you think that you can save their body, this point has been brought up before, you are wrong. Because, 27, one who has taken his birth is sure to die. And after death, one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. Onward, Arjuna. Don't be caught by this illusion. You cannot stop this cycle of birth and death, death and birth. And then, in 28, so in one verse there was, if you do believe in the soul's existence, another verse, if you don't believe in the soul's existence. In 28, either you believe in it or you don't believe in it. This verse is true. All created beings, in other words, the body, whether you believe there's a soul or you don't believe there's a soul, all created beings are unmanifest in their beginning. In other words, this body, at one point, right now, it is put together, lumped together as Birijan. But before, it was, I've been eating vegetables and things like that, and the vegetables came from the earth. So it is just a combination of earth, water, drinking so much water, and the fire of digestion, earth, water, fire, air, ether, like that. Mind, intelligence, and false ego.
It is just a combination of these things. And before this body was in existence, there's this a great reservoir of all these material elements. And from that reservoir of material elements, a reservoir of earth, some earth is taken to make up the body, and then according to the formula, some water is taken to make up the body, and some air and some fire, and it's put together in a pop, it becomes Brihaspatinadas. And then, so all created beings are unmanifest in their beginning. So there was a time when all the elements that are now manifest in the form of Brihaspatinadas, they were unmanifest. They were just in the form of elements. And so all created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state. For some time it remains like this. And unmanifest again when annihilated. So after the soul leaves the body, or if you don't believe in the soul, after death takes place, then they take the body and either burn it or bury it in the ground, and then there's that saying that they, in the Christian funerals, they say, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, something or other like that. And so you've come from dust, you've come from the earth, and now you're going back into the earth. You were unmanifested before, and you were manifested for some days, and now your body is being distributed again to the different elements. So what need is there for lamentation? So if you accept that the soul exists, this is what's going to happen to the body. It was unmanifested before, it is manifested for some time now only, and then it will be unmanifested again. If the soul exists, it's true. And if the soul doesn't exist, it's also true. So therefore, what need is there for lamentation? So either you have knowledge, Arjuna, or you don't have knowledge. What does knowledge mean? Knowledge means to know the difference between the soul and the body. So either you have knowledge, or you don't have knowledge. Still, you should do your duty. Stop this childish lamentation. And now, we will speak about the amazing verse 29. Some look on the soul as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. And some hear of him as amazing. While others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. So there are different ways of perceiving the soul. Acharyavat. This means wonderful. Isn't it wonderful or amazing? So, there's four lines in the sloka. So the first one is Acharyavat Pashyati Kasthireinam. So Pashyati means seeing. So in any grammar, and the second line, it's Vadati, or speaking. And the third is Shrinoti, or hearing. So some people see the soul as amazing, some people speak about the soul as amazing, and some people hear about the soul as amazing. So this verse can be interpreted in many ways. So this Acharyavat means amazing. So if you take a sentence, there's the subject, the verb, and the object. So a man, subject, sees, verb, The soul is the object. So the Acharyavat can be applied to either the subject, the verb, or the object. So if it's a subject, an amazing man, he's a subject, sees the soul. Because after all, it is amazing if a person in this world has such vision that he can actually see you and not see the body. So an amazing, the subject, if Acharyavat is applied to the subject, the amazing man sees the soul. And if you take Acharyavat, or amazing, or wonderful, and apply it to the verb, it's not the person who is wonderful, but the seeing who is wonderful. A man amazingly sees the soul. So it's the seeing that's amazing. How does one get that vision? to actually see the soul, which is spiritual. That is amazing. And then you can take that same Ascharyavat, amazing or wonderful, and apply it to the object or the soul itself. So it's a man sees the soul, which is amazing. Because the soul is amazing. Because there is one soul powering this entire body, even though it is so small. And if we look at an ant running across the mat, or if we look at a huge elephant, or if we look at the parrots chirping and flying in the trees and socializing at sunset, each one of those bodies, including this body and that body and that body, contains a soul, and it's powered by that soul, and that soul is giving the power and consciousness throughout the whole body. That is amazing. So the person who the person is amazing who sees the soul, the seeing is amazing, and the soul itself is amazing. So that's the first line. Ascharyavat pushyati kaschidenam. And then the second line, Ascharyavat vadati tataiva chanya, that what is amazing, speaking. An amazing person speaks about the soul. So the person who can speak about the soul within a material body is amazing. And the person who speaks, although his tongue is material, he's talking about something spiritual. And that's amazing. And again, the soul is amazing. So in each case, for the speaking, for the seeing, and the hearing, those people who are hearing about the soul are amazing people. Because there are millions and billions of human beings in this world, 4 billion human beings. And how many have an interest to hear about the soul? So the person who has an interest to hear about the soul is amazing. And the hearing process, again, is amazing. Because with this material ear, we are hearing about something spiritual. And that hearing is elevating us in consciousness from the material world to the spiritual world. And then again, to hear about a soul which has already been described as inconceivable, that is also amazing. So this is the amazing verse. Everything about it is amazing. Some look on the soul as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. And some hear of him as amazing. While others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. This is also amazing. That one person can hear about the soul, that he's an eternal soul, and he immediately understands it. Another person has no idea, even after hearing about it, doesn't make any sense to him. This is also amazing. How powerful the law of karma is, and how merciful Krishna is to mata smritam jnanam apovanam cha. He gives people knowledge through this hearing process. And in the next verse, Krishna sums up this jnana section of the Bhagavad Gita here. All this information that he has told Arjuna about the soul and its relationship to his duty, he sums it up by saying, O descendant of Bharata, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being. So Arjuna's whole argument about I cannot fight because of compassion, it is finished by knowledge of the soul. His whole argument about not wanting to fight to kill because he did not want to kill his loved ones, it is finished with his jnana or knowledge about the soul. It is finished. These arguments of Arjuna are finished by jnana. Now, Krishna is going to try to get Arjuna to fight. And of course, as we just heard, the conclusion is that Arjuna should fight here. Now Krishna is going to explain that Arjuna should fight from a completely different point of view, not on the jnana point of view, from the jnana level, which is quite elevated, but from the karma kanda level. Karma kanda
as we'll hear, thank you, in the third chapter, is the system of attaining sense gratification by following the Vedic scriptures. There is a system that fixes one in Vedic and Shastric activity, whereby one can become elevated and go to the heavenly planets and enjoy himself and do wonderful things, live for thousands and thousands of years. This is called Karma Kanda. So people who engage in the Vedas for this purpose are interested in sense gratification. And some of Arjuna's arguments were based on desire for sense gratification and lack of desire to suffer. So Krishna is going to approach those arguments from this Karma Kanda section. Considering your specific duty as a Kshatriya, you should know that there is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles. And so there is no need for hesitation. So on the jnana level, one does his duty, and that's all. But Krishna is going to explain something different over here. O Partha, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. So Krishna is explaining to Arjuna that here is your chance. You want to enjoy? Then you fight. And you will attain swarga. You will attain heaven. And not only that, you have so much affection for Bhishma and Drona and all the relatives, you can send them to heaven on the battlefield. And they could really enjoy. This is wonderful. Because this battlefield is the opening of the door for a Kshatriya to go to Swarga. If, however, you don't perform your religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duty and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. So Arjuna's argument, if you remember, one of his arguments was that if I fight in this battle, how can any good come from this fighting? Because if I kill these loved ones of mine, how will I even enjoy the kingdom? I will have the kingdom and the kingdom will be tainted with blood, and how will I be able to even enjoy the kingdom at the cost of the lives of these men whom I love so dearly? If I win, I will not be able to enjoy myself. I will have no one to enjoy with, and it will be miserable for me. And therefore, what is the value of my winning? I cannot enjoy. And if I lose, I'm going to be dead. But here, Krishna is saying in these two verses, if you lose the battle and so-called die, you will go to Swarga, and that will be a great victory for you to go to Swarga. And if you win the battle, you will have the kingdom. But if you don't fight in the battle, as you are saying, you will become sinful. You are afraid, Arjuna, that if you fight the battle, you will kill so many people, and that will cause you sin, and you'll have to suffer for so long. But here, Krishna is saying that if you don't fight in the battle, that is where the sin will come from, because you will be neglecting your prescribed duty, and that is the definition of sin. And not only that, in this world, you are known. You will not only go to heaven if you don't fight, but in this world, you will save your life, but you won't save your reputation as a fighter. And what will happen to you? Everyone will blaspheme you and criticize you. That's explained in the next verse. People will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. So if you don't fight, you will lose.
You will lose your reputation. You will suffer so much. It is worse than the death on the battlefield with arrows and lances piercing your heart. The dishonor that will come to you because you're a Kshatriya will cause you unlimited pain. It will burn you and scorch you. So it will be a horrible solution to your problem. You will be infamous. Prabhupada explains in the purport. Both as friend and philosopher to Arjuna, Lord Krishna now gives his final judgment regarding Arjuna's refusal to fight. The Lord says, Arjuna, if you leave the battlefield before the battle even begins, people will call you a coward. And if you think people may call you bad names, but you will save your life by fleeing the battlefield, then my advice is that you'd better die in the battle. For a respectable man like you, ill fame is worse than death. So you should not flee for fear of your life. Better to die in the battle. That will save you from the ill fame of misusing my friendship and from losing your prestige in society. So the final judgment of the Lord was for Arjuna to die in the battle and not withdraw. Next verse, 35. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think that you have left the battlefield out of fear only, and thus they will consider you insignificant. Prabhupada explains in the purport. Lord Krishna continued to give his verdict to Arjuna. Do not think that the great generals like Duryodhana, Karna, and other contemporaries will think that you have left the battlefield out of compassion for your brothers and grandfathers. They will think that you have left out of fear for your life, and thus their high estimation of your personality will go to hell. They will criticize you, Arjuna. Krishna is using all types of techniques to get Arjuna to fight from all different platforms, from the knowledge platform, from this material platform of fight and go to Swarga, and if you don't fight, you will be infamous. Of course, from the devotional platform, the devotee doesn't care about either going to Swarga, heavenly planets, or being blasphemed. But Krishna is speaking, and he will continue to speak on so many different levels, especially in the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna tells Arjuna, when you are leaving the battlefield, you will have me drive you. We're in the middle of the armies now, and there are 640 million people looking at us. And suddenly, we're going to leave and just keep driving away, and everyone's going to stare. And you're going to tell them, don't worry, I'm leaving, I'm not afraid. It's only because I'm compassionate that I'm leaving, and I don't want to cause anyone any harm. So I'm leaving the battlefield. No one should think that I'm leaving out of fear, because I'm not. And then Duryodhana and Karna say, oh, Arjuna, you are a very brave warrior, aren't you? Your back is very nice to look at. Oh, Arjuna, you are so compassionate, Kshatriya. Oh, we should all learn to be a compassionate Kshatriya like you, Arjuna. So in this way, Arjuna's reputation as a fighter, Arjuna, who was so famous that when the Kauravas were attacking the kingdom of Bharata, and he was just coming out of his incognito 1 year, and he was driving the chariot of Uttar Kumar. He was driving the chariot and dressed practically like a woman. And Uttar Kumar, he was saying, I will go and save, I will defeat all the Kauravas, I will do this. And Bhishma and Drona and Kripa, he became terrified. And he decided it would be much better to go in the opposite direction. And Krishna and Arjuna grabbed him and made him drive the chariot, and he started, he twanged his bow, the Gandiva bow, and all the warriors could understand that Arjuna was there, and he defeated them so badly and caused them to retreat. Arjuna took on practically all the generals of the Kaurava army himself, and he was known as the most powerful hero, and Duryodhana was so terrified of Arjuna And now Arjuna is going to run from the battlefield and everyone's going to think it's compassion? No. Krishna tells Arjuna, your whole reputation, and for a Kshatriya, reputation is so much. Your whole reputation will be finished. And that dishonor, again, will burn you and hurt you, give you more pain than all the arrows of your enemies put together. So therefore you should fight. They will consider you insignificant. You should fight. You must fight. Even if you lose, you will go to Swarga. What is the loss? If you win, you will gain the kingdom. Arjuna had been thinking, if I lose, I will be dead, and if I win, I cannot enjoy. And Krishna turns that around and says, if you lose, you will go to Swarga, and if you win, you will gain the kingdom. Therefore fight. And if you run, you cannot win. If you leave this battlefield, you gain your life, but you also gain infamy. And that is worse than death for you. Your enemies will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful for you? So this will be the result of your so-called compassion based on illusion. It will be infamy. You will become infamous, Arjuna. Slap, slap, slap. So therefore, this whole section based on gaining material success and fear of losing one's material position is summarized in text 37. O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavenly planets, or you will conquer and enjoy the earthly kingdom. Therefore, get up with determination and fight. Arjuna had said, if I win, I will lose because of the blood of my relatives. And if I lose because I'll be dead. And Krishna said, no, no, Arjuna, you have it wrong. If you lose, you will win because you'll go to Swarga. And if you win, you will win because you will be the king of the earth. Therefore, you should fight. Okay, we'll stop here. Tomorrow we should go from 38 to 53. We'll see if we can go through those verses. First, I'll just tell you the verses that we'll be responsible for the test. We'll try to make it not too many. There's 241. Very important. 241.
Powers, it is inconceivable. Looking at it from the mundane point of view, it is inconceivable. But it is obviously conceivable because Krishna is telling us the qualities. Something inconceivable can't have qualities, because as soon as you give it a quality, you can conceive of it. Right? So using the ascending process, using our own knowledge, we cannot understand the soul. But soon as we hear from authorities, just like we say that Krishna is also inconceivable, but we know that Krishna plays a flute, he has a peacock feather on his head, he stands at Vamsivat in the moonlight and attracts all the gopis. And we know that the cows won't give any milk until Krishna is there. So this is inconceivable, isn't it? How could God be like this? So we could speculate for millions of years and not come to this conclusion. But as soon as we accept descending knowledge, the inconceivableness becomes conceivable.
For the soul, there is never birth nor death.
Correct.
And the soul is part and parcel of the
Yes.
So there should be some time when it came out from...
No. It is also eternal. Shashvatoyam Purano. It is eternal, ever-existing, unborn. And in this sense, it is also inconceivable.
But the manifestation has started sometime.
It is eternal. It did, so we can't say, we say part and parcel, but we don't say that the soul came out of Krishna at some time, became manifest. No.
It is
eternal.
But it is said that Krishna was feeling alone, so he started the manifestation.
No. If things are said like that, it is just to give us an idea. But the soul is eternal. Krishna bhuli se jeev anadiya bahi mukh.
We can accept that soul is eternal because it is a part and parcel of Krishna.
But if eternal, it has, eternal means that it has no beginning.
But manifestation has started.
It manifests with, it's manifest and unmanifest and manifest and unmanifest. It sometimes is withdrawn into the body of Mahavishnu like that, and then sometimes it comes out again, all the universes are. And then billions and billions of years. But that is not the origin of the soul. There is no origin of the soul.
Yeah,
it is anadi.
But the manifestation must have origin.
It is eternal also. But it is manifest or unmanifested or manifest or unmanifest.
So
it's because Krishna is eternal, all his energies are also eternal.
So how can they say that he was feeling alone?
We say that just to give foolish people an understanding. He's never alone. And how could he, if he's feeling alone, it is not like us, like sometimes we are feeling lonely. He's God.
Yes.
He's Krishna. He is Satchidananda Vigraha. So it is to give less intelligent people some way to understand only. But someone who is spiritually advanced knows that Krishna doesn't feel alone. Look. Why should he feel alone? Look. Why should he feel alone? This is going on eternally. This is all Nitya Lila. So what is this feeling alone? It is just like when my daughter was very young, my wife would tell her, if you don't finish your prasadam, the man who lives on the roof is going to come down and beat you, or something like that. Even, right? But there's no man who lives on the roof. It's just a trick to get her to eat the prasadam. So sometimes the Shastra speaks on so many different levels. When we are young, it speaks in one way, and then we are older and more mature, the knowledge is more complete. Krishna wasn't feeling alone. He's never feeling alone. He is eternally enjoying in Goloka Vrindavan. He's eternally enjoying in Vaikuntha. He's eternally enjoying in Ayodhya. He's eternally enjoying everywhere. The material world is coming and going eternally. All the energies are eternal. This is actually the situation. And the soul has no beginning.
Just as a simple point that it mentions in verse 31 about how Kshatriya kings used to actually themselves fight between one another to decide the outcome, whereas nowadays they don't. So
with the armies, though, not just by themselves.
So some people might say, well, then it's only, it's not necessarily who's right or who's wrong, but who's more powerful.
Kshatriya's business is to be powerful. Yes, Kshatriyas have to be powerful. But also inherent in the Vedic philosophy is that where does power come from? Where? How do we get powerful? By the grace of God. So pious people will become powerful, impious people become weak. So victory or defeat is up to Krishna. Through power, through piety, one gets different weapons and shakti, austerities. Good triumphs over evil. And Krishna always takes the sides of the demigods over the demons. Because when the so the consciousness is a symptom of the soul, and the fact of consciousness doesn't change. The soul is conscious, and it is always conscious. But what it is conscious of changes. Just like there is water, and it has so many qualities. So I can put some red dye in the water, and it appears red. But the water isn't red. It is the dye that's red. Or if I put blue dye in the water, so the water appears blue. But the water isn't blue, it's the dye that's blue. Or I put mud in the water, and the water isn't muddy, although we say the water is muddy. The water is not muddy, it's the mud that's muddy. And if you leave the water sometime, the mud will settle down. The water never was muddy. The water is just what it is. So similarly, consciousness is always pure, but it appears to be mixed. So we have to learn the process of separating the pure consciousness from matter. And that's what chanting Hare Krishna does. Is that okay? Yes. Mataji. What? You should sell him a book. He's an individual. Don't expect people to be consistent. They never are. He was really hurt because of it pierced his heart so badly because it was his son. Due to his attachment to Asatam, it pierced his heart so deeply. Sometimes, if someone hurts us, we don't mind. But if someone hurts our child, oh, we become very vindictive. So of course, it wasn't the highest devotional platform to be in. It wasn't a sadhu platform. You're correct, it wasn't a sadhu platform. But he was a liberal brahmana, so when he approached him to teach, he begged him, he accepted it. So, somewhat inconsistent, but it's human nature.
Is there any reason why Kana would be so hateful towards the Pandava, specifically Arjuna, after all he was such a great soul being born from Kunti?
He was insulted. At the first time he appeared, before they were having a big contest, tournament. Bolo? You know that one?
But it seemed that he came into that arena and all, like very boastful and challenged Arjuna there.
Because this is the nature of a Kshatriya. They are bold. Krishna has given him that nature, that rajasic nature, for a particular purpose. Of course, it's their karma, but to protect the citizens, you have to be in that mood. How dare you challenge me? I am. You have to be in that mood. You can't be cowardly. You can't be tolerant. Someone has taken shelter of me. You touch one hair, I will kill you. I will sever your head from. This is the mood that a Kshatriya is born with. It's exhilarating. It is passionate. So they have their methods of elevation too. We need Kshatriyas who have that spirit.
but it is a particular spirit born of a nature. Chaturvanam maya shrisham gunakam abhagisham. This is created by Krishna. There are people who have that nature. It's glorious.
From where the soul is coming in this material existence?
What?
From where the soul is coming in this material existence?
From where this
soul is coming.
The soul is coming. This is explained in the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Sarva yonu shukantaya sanbhavad murtaya sambhavativa tasham brahma mahadyonya aham bija pradapita. That Krishna through his glance, also explained in Brahma Samhita, he injects the spirit souls within the material world again and again and again and again.
From where?
From where? From his glance, which is Shambhu. This starts the whole material cycle going again, and then it becomes unmanifest, and then he glances again. There is no beginning. And if you can't conceive that something that has no beginning, you are not alone, because no one can conceive of that. Because it's inconceivable. That's what Krishna meant. It's inconceivable. So therefore, one could ask this question eternally also. That if we're part and parcel of Krishna, there must be some time we came from Krishna, right? And when was that time? No, it's there eternally. But if we're part and parcel, there must be some time when it started. No, it's eternal. We're there eternally. But if we're part and parcel of Krishna, there must be some time when we came from Krishna. No, it's eternal. No. But if we're part and parcel of Krishna, there must be some time when we came from Krishna. Otherwise, how could we be part and parcel of Krishna? No, we're eternally in this material world, even though we're part and parcel of Krishna. But if we're part and parcel of Krishna, how is it that there's no time when it just can go on like that forever? Because it is inconceivable. Yes, it is inconceivable. It is spiritual. And this question of how the soul came to the material world, it is not an appropriate question. Actually, it is inconceivable. We are always in the material world. Anadi bahimukh, we have turned our back on Krishna. Since the very beginning. The beginning implies that there was a time when before, right? So when was that time before? Sorry, it's inconceivable. You cannot get anywhere with this question. The real point, it confounds the analytical mind. And we don't like things to confound and disturb the analytical mind. This one will. But so many things about Krishna. He is achintya. He is inconceivable. If he was conceivable, then he would not be God, because he would be able to fit in our finite mind. He is infinite. By definition, he cannot fit into our finite mind. He is inconceivable. And so many elements of the philosophy like that are achintya. Achintya, there's inconceivable relationship between Krishna and his energies. Inconceivable relationship between the souls in the material world too. If we are spirit souls, how are we in the material world? What is our relationship with the material world? There's actually a chintya, the relationship between Maya and the soul. Also. So the real question, unless one is a Shraddhadanaha Purusha, the real question is how to get out. So many devotees for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours have asked, how did we get? But when was the beginning? And where did this all end? There's no end. The real question is how to get out. And that's what we should put our energy into. Okay, thank you. Tomorrow we'll continue.